Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And in 2014, there were 211 homicides in Baltimore. It's now August the 18th, and we have 208 homicides. That doesn't count the shootings and other kinds of acts of violence in our community that are taking place that are on the sharp rise. We now, along with Detroit and St. Louis, are the three most dangerous cities in the United States of America. Baltimore's always been a tough place, which is why this town was originally called Mob Town. And it's always been a tough city. But tough and gritty is a long way from the kind of murders that we're experiencing. And while we have covered intensely on this program police behavior and tactics in the black community against black men and women, against young people, the brutality that has taken place, which is critical for us to put our hands around and change, we also have to wrestle with the fact that there is, as one person said on this program from Detroit, we have to address ghetto-side. We have to address the killings within the community and why that's going on and what to do, both in terms of the policy we have to push in the city, but also in terms of what people can do in a movement to take their hands and put their arms around it to change what's happening. Start the conversation off with you today. We want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. I know you have tons of ideas. We want to hear them. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook pages, email us at talk@steinershow.org, but please do call 410-319-8888. Join Avon Bellamy Sr., who is a Baltimore poet, writer, activist, who has spent his life working in communities to ameliorate the violence, to counsel young people, to create programs that work, and serve time, as he would say, on the corner himself until he separated himself from that life and built things to change, help change people's lives. Avon, good to have you in the studio. It's been a long time since you've been here, brother.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be here, especially on a topic like this, because it's of concern to everybody in the city. People are wrestling with the fact that they see it, it's horrendous, and they just feel like they can't do anything about it, and we need to change that attitude.
And Tara Huffman's in the studio, Tara Huffman is director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at OSI Baltimore. Tara, good to have you in the studio as well.
Thank you for the invitation, Mark.
410-319-8888. So let's get to something here. I mean, there's violence of this type across the country. It's in Chicago. It's in Oakland. It's all over. But what do you think is happening here in Baltimore? Why it's so intense in this community? Some people have come through here from other parts of the country that I've driven through town and have just been completely overwhelmed by the conditions, the physical conditions in poor black communities in Baltimore, poor working class black neighborhoods in Baltimore, just the conditions. I mean, Eddie Conway came out of jail after 43 years. The one thing he said to me afterwards when we were talking, he was blown away. He said he left a city where there were communities and people living and came to a place that looked like a bombed out, looked like Germany after World War II. He just blew his mind to see what Baltimore looked like. I mean, that as a setup, what is it about what's going on in our community that allows this to happen, that we're so out of control?
So I can tell you what my observations have been. I'm not originally from Baltimore. I'm originally from a little town in Ohio. I've been in the Baltimore area for about 18 years, and I've been in Baltimore City for about 13 years. And my observation has always been that if you look back over the last, let's say, four or five administrations in terms of both mayor and police, anytime there was a change in administration, you saw a bump or a rise in the homicide rate and in race of violence in Baltimore City. Just go back. It doesn't matter who the mayor was. It doesn't matter who the commissioner was. Whenever there was a change in administration, you saw a bump and a rise. And I have always read that to mean that any policing tactics, any crime reduction strategy that had been in place prior to that change in administration had merely put a lid on the problem. And as soon as somebody moved, the lid came off. And so the next person had to go back and put the lid back on the problem. But nothing was being done to address the root cause of the problem. So we were simply trying to suppress it, but we weren't actually solving it. And what's happening over the last several months is that since the death of Freddie Gray, at the hands of those police officers, the lid has blown off. And now the current administration is struggling to put the lid back on. But you have a community that's saying, no, 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 no. You're not going to be able to put a lid on this one fast enough, because those underlying problems that we haven't been dealing with for decades have finally come to fore. And tinkering around the edges, campaigns, that's not going to fix it. All of that systemic and institutional stuff that's been in place for decades now is basically saying, you're going to address me or you're going to lose this city.
I mean, and I would say that this very quickly, I'll turn to Avon right here, that yesterday Roberto Alejandro from the AFRO was something important to point out, that we were already on a rise towards a higher homicide rate before April 11th in this town. It might have risen a little bit since then, but we were already on a trajectory to beyond that. But Avon, you've written – one of the things that got to me when I asked you to come on, besides the fact that we've known each other for over 45 years – is that
and work together on problems exactly like these.
This? That's right. 40 years ago, we were in the same programs together, right, working on these issues, and we're pretty effective in some of the work that we did back in the early '70s.
We did effective work,
but I mean, when you wrote about your family, you know that your son was kidnapped and robbed, that you had the things have happened to your babies. I mean. It's political, it's social, it's the love of the black world, but it's also your family.
I have a young nephew that we just buried as a result of senseless violence in this city. My son was kidnapped at gunpoint in his car and taken off somewhere. He could have been murdered. I think the only thing that saved him was that I got a prayer life now. My daughter caught in a crossfire. My son caught in a crossfire in these violent streets. A lot of this stuff is undergirded with the drug has become a cottage market in this city, and the veering between gangs and others for some position in that to get what I call crumbs off of the economic table to suit their lifestyles. That's a part of this, but the worst part of it is that we have devalued ourselves so much as a people and divorced ourselves so much from what it took in our struggle to get to even where we are today, even though I can't look at that and say we've done great. We've done some things, but that's kind of gone now. I remember what my school life used to be when we had teachers telling us that we had to be twice as good as the white people in this system to get anything out of it. That left, that kind of ingenuity that said we can beat this, we can do better than this. We got kids now who don't want to go to school, who don't want to hear anything about an educational program, who are not educated to anything other than street life. And I want to say something about that, because we always think that street life and being educated to street life is a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that any time that you can get guys with the kind of intelligence that's necessary to put together illegal operations that Harvard Business School studied, that's a lot of intelligence. It's just aimed in the wrong directions. And I'd like to see that rechanneled. I said something to you the other day when we were on the phone, and it was about seeing the gangs come together.
Right.
When Freddie Gray's situation hit and abandon this tension between them and become a unified force now to actually do something of worth in the city. I looked at that and said, my God, if the warrior class is coming to the fore, we might be able to get over this. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, a bunch of body bags are back on the street again. I cannot believe that men who are as intelligent as those guys can't hear the voice of reason when it comes to dealing with issues like this.
And I think part of it is, I mean, this is one of the, I thought the two of you were interesting together. I mean, you think a lot about policy, but you also think about that community from the community out and how to change things in the black community in Tyra. You deal a lot with policy and how to change that, right? And they have to marry
they
and
have
meet.
To marry they, have to, they do have to marry.
To be to change what we're facing.
They do have to marry. You have to have the, you know, and this is my sociology degree coming to fore. You have to have the macro and the micro, right? You have to deal with what's going on at the systemic and institutional level, but also what's going on at the cultural level, at the community level, what's going on within homes, what's going on within neighborhoods, what kind of messages, what kind of lessons, what kind of expectations are being set of individuals within neighborhoods, communities, and schools, and then how does all of that feed into what's already a systemic institutional, systemic dysfunction, you know, within education, criminal justice, child welfare, economic development, community development. And so if you have dysfunctions within those larger systems and they meet the dysfunctions within the families and the communities, then you have a recipe for havoc. If you go after one without dealing with the other, then I think it gets back to that thing. You're sort of tinkering around the edges. You may achieve some progress, but it's only going to be for a short period of time because you haven't dealt with it very holistically and comprehensively. I've seen a number of people on my Facebook page, and they've been doing this for a number of years, you know, calling for a Marshall Plan, you know, right here in Baltimore City. It can't just, you know, master plans, community development plans, economic development plans. Those are all well and good, and they will serve a purpose, but it doesn't deal with the city on a holistic, large scale. We're including everybody, you know, not just one neighborhood, not just one school, not just one constituency, but an entire Marshall Plan or something like that for the entire city of Baltimore that deals with the macro, but also gets to those cultural issues. And as many maladies as there may be within the culture of Baltimore City, as you just said, there are also strengths and assets that are just simply not being tapped into and directed in the right directions. And so we see bad, 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 problem, 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 problem. We keep trying to throw solutions at the problem instead of also determining where are the strengths, where are the assets that we need to build, amplify, and multiply within the community so they can take over, overtake the, you know, the bad stuff that's going on.
So one of the things, let me throw this at you, Avon, and really want to wrestle with some ideas about what we can, what we should do. There was a really interesting article by this man named Raha Georgiani in the Washington Post recently. And his article, and he's an immigration defense attorney and at the Public Defender's Office in California at UC Davis Law School. And the article was called, Could Black People in the U.S. Qualify as Refugees?
Hmm. Saw that.
And one of the things he posits here, when he defends his clients, he says that he has to show that they are in fear of persecution by the government or by groups that the government was unable or unwilling to control and live in dire poverty and cannot find a way out. These are statuses that grant you refugee status, bringing people here. When you read that, what he's positing here is we're talking about black folks in America who live in the deepest poverty in this country next to Native people, and that's what we're facing. I mean, that's the root of what we're facing.
I think the root of what we face is being in a system based on racism and white supremacy that has never given its hold up on those things. The people in power have never released those as strategies to keep people divided, both black and white. Because the only way people can do what they're doing nowadays, right now, as we sit in this room, the only reason that people can continue to do these things is because they have divided the country so thoroughly now between white and black, Republican and Democrat. They can put anybody they want sitting in a seat over there that's supposed to rule our government and tell us where to go. All governed and ruled by Wall Street bankers, corporate overlords that conspire with these same bankers, and billionaires like the Kochs, who create a climate in which they can continue to rape the entire economic situation here in this country and have a bunch of white people and some blacks cheering as they do it. Until you can change that mindset, there's very little you're going to do about changing any of the other things that we're in here talking about. Because what we're talking about is systemic to that. If you removed all of that out of the situation and said, we're going to play on fair ground now. So everybody is going to be treated exactly right. We're going to give you justice. The minute you put justice in the mix, that means that you're supposed to be dealing with everybody who's called a citizen on the same equal plane, whether they have $1 billion, $1 million, or $75. That changes how we're going to start relating to each other, because right now we don't relate to each other as human beings. We relate to each other as categories. Right now we're in a category. There's the category of black people, the category of white people, the category of rich people, the category of poor people, etc. Those need to be dealt with fairly. If we can do all of that, we can make a change. But as long as somebody is sitting with a dollar bill over top of this system, and this is not, this is the other thing, this has never been about color. It's always been about money. You can go back to the populist movement, and I know you're familiar with that movement. That movement was against white farmers and people who were in that dynamic, and they treated them identically to the way they dealt with black people who were in an uprising against them. The exact thing. All of the same riots, et cetera. All of that happened. The only way those people got out of it is they refused to buckle under to the buck. And they finally made a deal for themselves that could partially work. The minute they took it into the political sphere, they got busted, and it broke down the whole thing, and it was back to business as usual. Brian, so I throw that in the mix. Okay, I know that's a lot to say, but I throw that in the mix.
Brian Stevenson, who recently wrote a book, Just Mercy, says that in his years of advocacy on behalf of people who have been wrongly accused within the criminal justice system and fighting for their innocence to get them released and vindicated, he says that he's learned that the opposite of poverty isn't wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. And I think Baltimore City, along with other jurisdictions across the nation, but I think Baltimore City is sort of, I don't want to use the term poster child, but I think it sort of demonstrates that sentiment, that the opposite of, because you can look at investments that have been made in Baltimore City. You know, this community development plan, that master plan, you know, people talk about the investments that were made in Sandtown Winchester and why is it that Sandtown Winchester looks the way it looks right now. You know, people have talked about, you know, investments that have been made in Park Heights and why does Park, you know, Southern Park Heights still, because wealth or money or just money alone isn't going to solve the problem. The opposite of poverty and the systemic racism, the institutionalized discrimination that we see right now, the opposite of that isn't more money. The opposite of that is justice. And I think what you have right now are people all over Baltimore City of all shapes and sizes and colors, but particularly of a younger generation and mostly African American who are standing up and saying, yes, we do want more investments in our community, but in addition to that, we also want justice. What we have been denied is justice. The reason why we go to an alternative economy is because we can't participate in the mainstream economy. We're locked out of it, literally and figuratively. So we're going to go over here and create our own economy with our own rules and our own culture, because there's no equity. There's no equity in that other system for us. So we're going over here.
So I want to go to the phones here and see what people are thinking about, what they think should happen. But I really want to focus on how we have a mayoral election coming up. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that I'm excited, but we have a mayoral election coming up. And one of the issues has to be is how we begin to change what we do in the city. To change. I was glad to see in this morning's paper that the city, I haven't read the article yet, I need to finish the article, how big it's going to be, but they're going to, instead of attacking safe streets because of one bust, they're going to expand safe streets. But they need to expand a lot of things. And so the question is, how do we get to that point and what should be the changes we make and how we get there? Listen to what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. Kenneth, line 3, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
Good morning, Kenneth.
Yes. Who is the gentleman that is there with you? I'm sorry. I didn't get his name.
Avon Bellamy.
This gentleman has said everything correct, and everything I've been saying for months on WEAA, on all the shows. And thank you, sir. Okay. Let me say my little bit, though. But if money is not going to solve the problem, politics is not going to solve the problem, churches and everything else, then here's what I have. Remember how the city was when we bought the, and I know you're going to get mad, some people ain't going to agree.
What is it?
Remember how when we had the National Guard here, or you might want to say the boots on the ground, when we had the National Guards here, remember how calm, remember how good you felt because the crime rate had went down to zero. Remember that? They were only here for 3 weeks, three, 4 weeks? We need to bring them back. Bring them back, and however long it takes, keep them here. Because it made a difference. And while everybody, while the police department trying to figure out their strategy, politics are trying to figure out their strategy, the community trying to figure out their strategy, we're going to keep the National Guard here to give order. That's what it takes. That's all they people understand right now. This is all Baltimore understands.
So we need martial law.
No, I understand the point that the brother's making. But he missed why that happened.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And welcome here to the Mark Steiner Show this morning. We want you to join us at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, or send us an email, talk@steinershow.org. We're going to talk about the battle in the U.S. Congress and other issues in the Middle East, but the battles in the U.S. Congress around whether or not we will ratify this negotiated treaty with Iran. We're joined by Phyllis Bennis, who is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of numerous books, her most recent, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer, and Dr. Stephen David, professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. His most recent book is Catastrophic Consequences, Civil Wars and American Interests. And Stephen and Phyllis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Nice to be here.
So let me ask you both to, if you can explain, I'll start with you, Stephen David, the opposition to this deal that limits Iran for the next 10 years, that even it seems like a number of Israeli generals have said that it's interesting looking at going over the report they put out recently, there's hardly a mention of Iran or nuclear power other than to say that this might limit their ability to attack Israel for 10 years or develop this kind of weaponry. So talk about the opposition to this.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that there are strong arguments on both sides of this agreement. I mean, it's not formally a treaty. If it was a treaty, it would have required 2/3 vote of the Senate, and that certainly wasn't going to happen. The opposition is based on several factors. First of all, it's going to release a lot of money to Iran. I mean, there's some dispute as to exactly how much, but it's probably in the neighborhood of $100 billion. And Iran is a source of a great deal of mischief in the Middle East, and to be empowered with over $100 billion, some of that money may go to Hamas, Hezbollah, and therefore create greater problems for the United States and its allies. There are other issues, too. I mean, the inspections in the agreement are a little sketchy. Military sites can take up to 24 days to inspect, at which time Iran can presumably move things around and cover up some nefarious activities. I think mostly, I think what people are upset is that it legitimizes Iran as a nuclear power. I mean, when these negotiations began, the United Nations and others said Iran has no right to enrich, given its previous activities
right. In
hiding nuclear activities. At the end of 10 or 15 years, even if Iran adheres to the treaty, it will be prepared to break out and become a major nuclear weapon state. And that concerns a lot of people, and I think justifiably so.
And Phyllis Bennis, what about those questions?
Well, I think that each of them has an answer that's been answered over and over and over again. First of all, this is an agreement about Iran's nuclear power processes. It's not about where it uses its money. It's not about its regional role. It's not about human rights. It's not about a whole bunch of things. It's about one thing. It's about Iran's nuclear power program. Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. It has a nuclear power program. So what, you know, just the specific things that we just heard about the money that's going to be released. Well, it's somewhere about about 59 to 65 or so billion dollars. So, yeah, that's a lot of money. But the question is, what's it going to do with the money? We just heard from an Iranian official that was on BBC this morning saying, you know, we're in the middle of a five-year plan, and people are demanding that that money be spent on a lot of infrastructure issues and other internal issues. I have no doubt that there will continue to be money going to the regime in Syria as well as to Hezbollah. But what's been clear is that even during the worst of the sanctions, when the people of Iran were really suffering, the government was still prepared to use that money to support their allies. That's not going to change, but it's not going to change the situation qualitatively. On the inspections, all nuclear sites are subject, and Iran agreed to this, 24/7, anywhere, anytime inspections. The ones that are not are any place in the country that somebody, the U.S. or somebody else, says, you know, I don't have any evidence, but I think that site is going to be used for some kind of nuclear thing. Then Iran can appeal it. There's this process, and yeah, it could take up to 24 days. During that 24 days, that site is going to be under complete surveillance from the outside. They won't be allowed in. That's true. But if we're talking about nuclear anything, that's not something you can, you know, pack up and hide in the refrigerator. It's not something you can put in a jar in the garage. We're talking large processes here. So the idea that somehow a place that's been identified and is under complete surveillance at all times is somehow going to allow Iran to slip by is simply, in my view, a really specious argument. On the question of the legitimacy, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and as such, it has the right to a peaceful nuclear power process to produce and use nuclear power for peaceful purposes. That means medical stuff, power, whatever. We shouldn't forget this was all started by when the U.S. had to convince the Shah, who didn't want to start nuclear power, because he said, we have all the oil in the world. Why would we do this? And the U.S. convinced them that, no, it would really be good for you to have a diversification of your energy processes. And, oh, by the way, why don't you buy a nuclear power reactor from Westinghouse? So this goes back to the 70s under the Shah, and it's continued ever since. But the notion that the problem is Iran being legitimized, Iran is a legitimate signer, unlike Israel, which has nuclear weapons, not a nuclear power program, a nuclear weapons program, with 200 to 400 high-density nuclear bombs at the plant in Dimona. And while nobody in the U.S. government wants to talk about that, they accept the Israeli notion of strategic ambiguity. We will neither confirm nor deny that we have these weapons, et cetera, et cetera. The whole world knows that those weapons exist, and they are hugely destabilizing in the region. So the notion that somehow this is about we shouldn't be allowing Iran, which is a signatory and has signed on to the most intrusive inspection regime really in diplomatic history with this agreement, that somehow that's the issue, while the issue of the illegitimacy of Israel's nuclear weapons is simply a false argument, I think.
So before I ask a specific question about this and where the U.S. may be going and Congress may be going, I heard kind of a verbal response, a guttural response, Steve. What were you responding to?
Well, the notion that Iran is a legitimate nuclear power already, let's be clear about a couple of things. First, Iran violated the Nonproliferation Treaty. Its enrichment facilities, Natanz and Fordo, were not disclosed by Iran as it was obligated to do as a signatory to the Nonproliferation Treaty.
Right.
But it was revealed through intelligence means. They were caught cheating, in other words. And yes, Israel is a nuclear weapon state. I mean, I disagree with Phyllis that it was destabilizing. I think, in fact, it's a very stabilizing factor in that it convinces its enemies that Israel can't be destroyed by military means. The difference, I think, with Israel and Iran is that Iran has openly called for Israel's destruction. Its leaders, its military leaders, its political leaders. I don't recall Israeli leaders calling for Iran's destruction or the destruction of any other state.
No, they must try to
Iran
attack
in a different category.
They haven't called for it. That's true.
But what were you saying, Phyllis? They have called what?
They just tried to attack it. They used the assassination of the nuclear scientists, and they collaborated with the U.S. on the Stuxnet, I don't know how to pronounce it, that computer bug to destroy it. So they just try to do it. They don't talk about it in the same way.
Well, it's different in trying. There's a difference in trying to destroy a nuclear weapons program and destroying an entire state.
That's true. And as far as I know, Iran has not attacked Israel, nor has it attacked any other country in the region.
But as far as you know, I assume you would acknowledge that the Iranian leadership has called for the destruction of
Israel. I acknowledge that the last Iranian president, who was defeated, did call for ending the Zionist regime. He did not use the language. As we know, this has been proven over and over again.
It has not been proven.
It's not a frame in Farsi to say called for the end of the Jewish people or the Israeli state or the Jewish state or anything like that. He called for the end to the Zionist regime.
Okay, well, even getting,
a, well, I have no doubt that he's a terrible
person. By many translations, talked about Israel
anymore.
Being wiped off the map. But he's
so,
gone.
But he's gone.
But the present leadership has called, Khamenei has said Israel is a cancerous tumor that must be removed.
But all due respect, I mean, people on all sides of the Middle East, complex within the Middle East, use all kinds of language to degrade and dehumanize the other side.
Okay.
Israelis do it as well. The Palestinians do it. The Iranians do it. They all do it.
In all due respect, right? and I hate to invoke the Holocaust here, but I think one of the lessons of
Please
the Holocaust
don't.
Is when people talk about destroying you and say they're going to destroy you, you don't want to simply dismiss it as empty rhetoric, especially when it's a country like Iran, which is now getting the capability to do what its leaders are threatening to do.
Well, first of all, it's not getting the capability. It doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. We have to repeat that over and over and over again.
Well, how do you know that?
We saw it in the New York Times, Washington Post yesterday,
reference to Iran's
nuclear weapons program.
You don't know that at all. How can you be so certain
of that? It doesn't
have
one.
It's certain. Why does Iran, a country awash in oil and natural gas, spend tens of billions of dollars on developing nuclear fuel that it can buy in the open market at a fraction of the
price? Part of it is about respect. Let's be clear. The same reason that Israel has nuclear weapons. They want respect in the region, and like too many other countries, including our own, there's this false belief that somehow having nuclear weapons makes you more important for Israel.
No,
for
Iran, it's not about respect.
They want
it's about
control
having a license
over the process of
telling
producing
potential
nuclear
one at a time.
That if they try and destroy you,
one at a time. Stephen, let's finish our statement. We can't hear both talking at the
Iran
same time.
Iran has made clear that they want the right to control their own access to nuclear fuel. And they have agreed in the new agreement to complete inspection, 24/7 inspection of the entire nuclear fuel processing. That means everything from the mines where they might mine uranium to the processing of uranium into gas to the enrichment of uranium up to 3.5%. Keep in mind, weaponized uranium needs to go up to over 92%. Iran has never had anything except for one set of centrifuges that for a brief moment could get up to 20%, and that didn't last. But their machines are now limited to the production of 3.5% enrichment. That's what you need for nuclear power. That's what they're going to be allowed to produce. This isn't a nuclear weapons program.
Let me just ask this question. It's very quickly, Stephen, but I think we need to get back to the reality of what's happening in the U.S. Congress before we run out of time. Go ahead.
Well, the same enrichment capability that gets you to 3.5%, by spinning the nuclear gas additionally, will get you to 90%. In fact,
and that's why they're not going to be allowed to do it.
It's easier to get from 0.7% to 3%. 0.7% is where the uranium starts.
But let's deal with a couple of realities here. Now, let's talk about the reality of what's happening in the U.S. Congress. Let's say, for argument's sake, that the Republican majority and the folks with AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, and others have their way and win the battle. It's most likely that the vote in Congress will vote against the nuclear agreement.
Right.
But then President Obama will veto it. It has to go back to the U.S. Congress. And at this point, it's really up to Democrats whether they're going to support the deal or not support the deal, support the president, not support the president. And if they do not support the president, if they override his veto and kill the deal, from what I understand, it means that the deal is gone, but that all the other nations that have already said that have put sanctions in place against Iran will no longer honor those sanctions, but will go ahead with their agreements with Iran.
Exactly.
I mean, what could be set up if this is not signed?
I think that what we're looking at is exactly what you just said, Mark. We're looking at a scenario where the U.S. would be even more isolated than it is now. There are no more negotiations. That's been very clear. You know, this notion that we hear from Republican candidates and others in the punditry, I would be stronger. I would go back and start the negotiations again. Well, I don't know who they think they're going to negotiate with. There's nobody left in Vienna. Everybody went home. The negotiations are over. That boat has sailed. This is the deal. The choice is between this deal and not a deal. It's not between this deal and some elusive better deal that would require an Iranian collapse, a complete, you know, get down on your knees and say, I will do whatever you tell me. That's not going to happen. There are no more negotiations to be had. These 18 months of negotiations were it. The other countries are going to abide by the resolution. Hopefully, Iran would simply shake their collective heads and say, oh, the U.S. is out of control again. Why don't they even abide by what they say they're going to abide by? And they will ignore the U.S. as much as possible. The danger, of course, from as proposed by somebody like Carly Fiorini, who just said that she thinks it's a done deal in Congress. She doesn't think there's much Congress can do. But if she were to be elected president, the first thing she would do would be to ensure that Iran was not able to engage with the global banking system because, what a surprise, the U.S. dollar has a supreme role in the U.S. in the international banking system. And she would do that to ensure that Iran was isolated from the rest of the world. And you have to ask yourself, what would that do to U.S. relations with what would then be Iran's significant trading partners, places like Germany, Japan, the U.K., France, all of our allies who are eager to trade with Iran, to normalize relations with Iran? It would lead to a complete isolation of the U.S. diplomatically, and it would completely undermine the trust that any governments might still have in U.S. diplomacy.
Stephen, what are your thoughts on that? Different or the same?
Well, I must say it's ironic in that some of my, as Mark, as you know, if I were in Congress, I would vote to support the agreement. And some of my biggest fights with my colleagues and others have been my decision that I think it's better to have this this agreement than not. Well, I must say, in listening to Phyllis's, I feel, exaggerated defense of this agreement, it's almost making me rethink my support of it.
Why?
Because I understand the opposition. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. You are, again, legitimizing a state to have a very large nuclear infrastructure that, even if it abides by the treaty, and after 10 years, it can break out, and even in President Obama's words, have a nuclear weapon almost immediately. And, you know, we can parse words, nuclear program, not nuclear program. If you have large numbers of centrifuges, you have the ability to enrich uranium to 90%, whether you call it for peaceful purposes or not. And virtually overnight, Iran can develop into a nuclear weapon state. And, I mean, the hope that I have is that if Iran engages in the international economic world, that its moderate population will prevail and these crazy mullahs will be shunted aside or at least moderated. And at the end of this, Iran will not be the threat that it is today. And my other concern is that no one has explained to me what Plan B is, that you have to lay out for me what walking away from the plan, how that puts us in a better situation. And to me, it doesn't. But that doesn't mean that this is a good treaty. My view, it's a bad treaty, but it's better than no treaty at all.
And perhaps we could agree that what's important is to make sure that Congress hears the voices of people who think this agreement, it's not a treaty, that this agreement must be supported. You know, Congress is under enormous pressure. AIPAC has put now 40 million. They originally said 20. Now they've said 40 million, created a new organization, United Against Nuclear Iran, put in $40 million just for this 60-day period, and they are inundating every ad market. The Washington Post every day has full-page ads addressed to specific single members of Congress. It's a hugely powerful process, and I think it's important that everybody who recognizes, for whatever reason, whether you agree with all of it or don't agree with all of it, but recognize that supporting this agreement is important, needs to be engaged with members of Congress to make that clear.
Okay, AIPAC certainly has the right to do what it does, and I certainly hope, Phyllis, that you and others who have talked about the disproportionate influence of AIPAC and other pro-Israeli lobbies in the United States, I hope you and others, if this agreement does pass Congress, will acknowledge that perhaps AIPAC's power is not what has been purported to be.
I think AIPAC power is way lower than it used to be.
I'm not going to hold my breath.
I've written about it.
But I hope.
I think it remains a hugely powerful lobby. It's not the most important. And luckily, and I'm very grateful, and I take a little bit of credit organizationally with all the people I work with in organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, who have worked very hard to diminish AIPAC's power, and I think they've had some success, and I'm very proud of that.
Well, certainly there is lobbying efforts on the other side as well. It's
true. They have raised they've managed
to
raise less than $1 million.
And other groups,
let me be clear.
That are pushing for the approval of this agreement.
Absolutely, and that's where you have people pushing very,
simply,
very hard. There are people calling in the hundreds of thousands to their members of Congress. You don't have people donating $40 million. You do have people on the ground calling their own representatives and urging them.
Okay, but let's be clear here. AIPAC has people, too. There are a lot of good thinking people who are not motivated by money, who genuinely feel that this agreement is not in the interest of the United States. And I don't think it's right to even indirectly impugn their motives, too. There are good reasons to oppose this agreement. I don't feel that they should carry the day, but I don't impugn the motives of people who
I'm not impugning anybody's motives. I'm saying that when you have $40 million put in by one organization into a 60-day ad campaign, you're up against a really big chunk of money.
Okay.
And and we've had shows around AIPAC before, and we'll have more conversations with them on the air as well. And I think it's important to note that when the polls have shown interestingly enough, that the one community in America where the majority of people support the deal in Iran, other than the African American and other Latino communities, is the Jewish community that supports the deal.
And even
Mark,
more
I
than the American people overall.
It's important to note that Jews and much of AIPAC money has been associated with the Democratic Party, but it's
not
the Republicans
lately
who are lockstep against this agreement. And my guess is they're going to get near unanimous opposition to this agreement in the Republican Party. So the notion that somehow this is AIPAC simply pulling strings ignores the fact that there's a large constituency in this country that opposes this treaty that has nothing to do with AIPAC.
That's certainly true. But it's also true that AIPAC often claims to represent the Jewish community, which supports this deal. The latest poll I saw is 63% of Jews support it, 54% of the American public as a whole support it. So AIPAC is completely out of line with the constituency they claim to represent.
So the two of you are always wonderful in this program together because you bring really interesting viewpoints that are different, but also in many ways attached. So I think it's really important for us to be able to wrestle with this in this manner.
Phyllis, thanks, Mark. As I told you, I do have to leave for another one.
No, we're ending this now anyway because we have another
program.
That way I appreciate it. Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her latest book is Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a Primer. And Dr. Stephen David, who's professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, whose most recent book is Catastrophic Consequences, Civil Wars and American Interest. Stephen and Phyllis, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. It was fun.
We're going to take a quick break and come right back, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is how to make its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And coming up on the Mark Steiner Show in the next hour, we discuss the upsurge of violence in Baltimore with Baltimore activist, poet, and writer Avon Bellamy, OSI's Tara Huffman, and others joining us as we talk about what's going on in Baltimore, where we've now experienced 208 homicides. It's only August the 18th. And over 2014, Baltimore experienced less homicides. What's going on? What can we do to address it? We'll discuss that when we return. Stay with us.
WEAA remembers the life and legacy of Julian Bond. In 1967, Julian Bond spoke to television station KVOS about his opposition towards the Vietnam War.
We ought not be there. We ought to disengage ourselves, and that there will never be decent treatment for minority peoples in this country until we begin to concentrate on freedom and justice and equality for those at home and stop worrying about puppet dictatorships and despotic governments in Southeast Asia.
Bond wore many hats, serving as an activist and leader in the civil rights movement. He was also a politician, professor, and writer. While Bond was a student at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia during the 1960s, he co-founded SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Through this organization, he met Eleanor Holmes Norton, who after joining SNCC was inspired to commit her life to activism. Since 1991, Norton has been a delegate for the U.S. House of Representatives, and she had the opportunity to work with Bond during his last days.
Well, to the very end, until indeed just a few months ago, when he and I had an intergenerational forum with leaders from Ferguson and New York after the police shootings. That's the Julian Bond I knew, the Julian Bond who, in his own way, never left the civil rights movement.
President Barack Obama and many others remember Julian Bond as a hero and a friend. He will be missed by many, but his passion for equality will live on. Bond died on Saturday, August 15th, from complications of vascular disease. He was 75.
Remembering the life and legacy of Julian Bond on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM.
Support for WEAA is provided by
Northwood Appold Community Academy, now recruiting scholars for the 2015-2016 school year. Looking for a new educational opportunity for your child? NACA currently has space to enroll kindergarten scholars and limited availability for 4th and 5th grade scholars as well. Applications available in the lobby of the school or with the school registrar. 410-323-9546 or 9547. More details available at nacacad.org. That's nacacad.org.
And members like you. Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, parents fighting for the services their children need.
When the district denies something, a program, a service, something that your child needs, usually the school tells you, no, he doesn't need it, we don't do that, things like that.
Do you know your rights? That's next time on Latino USA.
Latino USA, Tuesday nights at 11, following Fiesta Musical on WEAA 88.9 FM.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And in 2014, there were 211 homicides in Baltimore. It's now August the 18th, and we have 208 homicides. That doesn't count the shootings and other kinds of acts of violence in our community that are taking place that are on the sharp rise. We now, along with Detroit and St. Louis, are the three most dangerous cities in the United States of America. Baltimore's always been a tough place, which is why this town was originally called Mob Town. And it's always been a tough city. But tough and gritty is a long way from the kind of murders that we're experiencing. And while we have covered intensely on this program the police behavior and tactics in the black community against black men and women, against young people, the brutality that has taken place, which is critical for us to put our hands around and change, we also have to wrestle with the fact that there is, as one person said on this program from Detroit, we have to address ghetto-side. We have to address the killings within the community and why that's going on and what to do, both in terms of the policy we have to push in the city, but also in terms of what people can do in a movement to take their hands and put their arms around it to change what's happening. start the conversation off with you today. We want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. I know you have tons of ideas. We want to hear them. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook pages, email us at talk@steinershow.org, but please do call 410-319-8888. Enjoy Avon Bellamy Sr., who is a Baltimore poet, writer, activist, who has spent his life working in communities to ameliorate the violence, to counsel young people, to create programs that work, and serve time, as he would say, on the corner himself until he separated himself from that life and built things to change, help change people's lives. Avon, good to have you in the studio. It's been a long time since you've been here, brother.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be here, especially on a topic like this, because it's of concern to everybody in the city. People are wrestling with the fact that they see it. It's horrendous. And they just feel like they can't do anything about it. And we need to change that attitude.
And Tara Hoffman's in the studio, Tara Hoffman is director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at OSI Baltimore. Tara, good to have you in the studio as well.
Thank you for the invitation, Mark.
410-319-8888. So let's get to something here. I mean, there's violence of this type across the country. It's in Chicago. It's in Oakland. It's all over. But what do you think is happening here in Baltimore? Why it's so intense in this community? Some people have come through here from other parts of the country. I've driven through town and have just been completely overwhelmed by the conditions, the physical conditions in poor black communities in Baltimore, poor working class black neighborhoods in Baltimore, just the conditions. I mean, Eddie Conway came out of jail after 43 years. The one thing he said to me afterwards when we were talking, he was blown away. He said he left a city where there were communities and people living and came to a place that looked like a bombed out, looked like Germany after World War II. He just blew his mind to see what Baltimore looked like. I mean, to that as a setup, what is it about what's going on in our community that allows this to happen, that we're so out of control?
So I can tell you what my observations have been. I'm not originally from Baltimore. I'm originally from a little town in Ohio. I've been in the Baltimore area for about 18 years, and I've been in Baltimore City for about 13 years. And my observation has always been that if you look back over the last, let's say, four or five administrations in terms of both mayor and police, anytime there was a change in administration, you saw a bump or a rise in the homicide rate and in race of violence in Baltimore City. Just go back. It doesn't matter who the mayor was. It doesn't matter who the commissioner was. Whenever there was a change in administration, you saw a bump and a rise. And I have always read that to mean that any policing tactics, any crime reduction strategy that had been in place prior to that change in administration had merely put a lid on the problem. And as soon as somebody moved, the lid came off. And so the next person had to go back and put the lid back on the problem. But nothing was being done to address the root cause of the problem. So we were simply trying to suppress it, but we weren't actually solving it. And what's happening over the last several months is that since the death of Freddie Gray at the hands of those police officers, the lid has blown off. And now the current administration is struggling to put the lid back on. But you have a community that's saying, no, 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 no. You're not going to be able to put a lid on this one fast enough, because those underlying problems that we haven't been dealing with for decades have finally come to fore. And tinkering around the edges, campaigns, that's not going to fix it. All of that systemic and institutional stuff that's been in place for decades now is basically saying, you're going to address me or you're going to lose this city.
I mean, and I would say that this very quickly, I'll turn to Avon right here, that yesterday Roberto Alejandro from the Afro pointed out that we were already on a rise towards a higher homicide rate before April 11th in this town. It might have risen a little bit since then, but we were already on a trajectory to beyond that. But Avon, you've written – one of the things that got to me when I asked you to come on, besides the fact that we've known each other for over 45 years –
And work together on problems exactly like these.
Right, 40 years ago, we were in the same programs together, right, working exactly on these issues. And we're pretty effective in some of the work that we did back in the early 70s.
We did effective work.
But, I mean, when you wrote about your family, you know, that your son was kidnapped and robbed, that you had the same – that things have happened to your babies. I mean, It's gotten, it's political, it's social, it's the love of the black world, but it's also your family.
I have a young nephew that we just buried as a result of senseless violence in this city. My son was kidnapped at gunpoint in his car and taken off somewhere. He could have been murdered. I think the only thing that saved him was that I got a prayer life now. My daughter caught in a crossfire. My son caught in a crossfire in these violent streets. A lot of this stuff is undergirded with the drug has become a cottage market in this city, and the veering between gangs and others for some position in that to get what I call crumbs off of the economic table to suit their lifestyles. That's a part of this. But the worst part of it is that we have devalued ourselves so much as a people and divorced ourselves so much from what it took in our struggle to get to even where we are today, even though I can't look at that and say we've done great. We've done some things. But that's kind of gone now. I remember what my school life used to be when we had teachers telling us that we had to be twice as good as the white people in this system to get anything out of it. That left, that kind of ingenuity that said we can beat this, we can do better than this. We got kids now who don't want to go to school, who don't want to hear anything about an educational program, who are not educated to anything other than street life. And I want to say something about that, because we always think that street life and being educated to street life is a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that any time that you can get guys with the kind of intelligence that's necessary to put together illegal operations that Harvard Business School studied, that's a lot of intelligence. It's just aimed in the wrong directions. And I'd like to see that rechanneled. I said something to you the other day when we were on the phone, and it was about seeing the gangs come together.
Right.
When Freddie Gray's situation hit and abandoned this tension between them and become a unified force now to actually do something of worth in the city. I looked at that and said, my God, if the warrior class is coming to the fore, we might be able to get over this. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, a bunch of body bags are back on the street again. I cannot believe that men who are as intelligent as those guys can't hear the voice of reason when it comes to dealing with issues like this.
And I think part of it is, I mean, this is one of the, I thought the two of you were interesting together. I mean, you think a lot about policy, but you also think about that community from the community out and how to change things in the black community entire. You deal a lot with policy and how to change that, right? And they have to marry and meet.
They do have to marry.
To be able to change what we're facing.
They do have to marry. You have to have the, you know, and this is my sociology degree coming to fore. You have to have the macro and the micro, right? You have to deal with what's going on at the systemic and institutional level, but also what's going on at the cultural level, at the community level, what's going on within homes, what's going on within neighborhoods, what kind of messages, what kind of lessons, what kind of expectations are being set of individuals within neighborhoods, communities, and schools, and then how does all of that feed into what's already a systemic institutional, systemic dysfunction, you know, within education, criminal justice, child welfare, economic development, community development. And so if you have dysfunctions within those larger systems and they meet the dysfunctions within the families and the communities, then you have a recipe for havoc. If you go after one without dealing with the other, then I think it gets back to that thing. You're sort of tinkering around the edges. You may achieve some progress, but it's only going to be for a short period of time because you haven't dealt with it very holistically and comprehensively. I've seen a number of people on my Facebook page, and they've been doing this for a number of years, you know, calling for a Marshall Plan, you know, right here in Baltimore City. It can't just, you know, master plans, community development plans, economic development plans, those are all well and good and they will serve a purpose, but it doesn't deal with the city on a holistic, large scale, we're including everybody, you know, not just one neighborhood, not just one school, not just one constituency, but an entire Marshall Plan or something like that for the entire city of Baltimore that deals with the macro, but also gets to those cultural issues. And as many maladies as there may be within the culture of Baltimore City, as you just said, there are also strengths and assets that are just simply not being tapped into and directed in the right directions. And so we see bad, 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 problem, 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 problem. We keep trying to throw solutions at the problem instead of also determining where are the strengths, where are the assets that we need to build, amplify, and multiply within the community so they can take over, overtake the, you know, the bad stuff that's going on.
So one of the things, let me throw this at you, Avon, and really want to wrestle with some ideas about what we can, what we should do. There was a really interesting article by this man named Raha Georgiani in the Washington Post recently. And his article, and he's an immigration defense attorney and at the Public Defender's Office in California at UC Davis Law School. And the article was called, Could Black People in the U.S. Qualify as Refugees?
Hmm. Saw that.
And one of the things he posits here, when he defends his clients, he says that he has to show that they are in fear of persecution by the government or by groups that the government was unable or unwilling to control and live in dire poverty and cannot find a way out. These are statuses that grant you refugee status, bringing people here. When you read that, what he's positing here is we're talking about black folks in America who live in the deepest poverty in this country next to Native people, and that's what we're facing. I mean, that's the root of what we're facing.
I think the root of what we face is being in a system based on racism and white supremacy that has never given its hold up on those things. The people in power have never released those as strategies to keep people divided, both black and white. Because the only way people can do what they're doing nowadays, right now, as we sit in this room, the only reason that people can continue to do these things is because they have divided the country so thoroughly now between white and black, Republican and Democrat. They can put anybody they want sitting in a seat over there that's supposed to rule our government and tell us where to go. All governed and ruled by Wall Street bankers, corporate overlords that conspire with these same bankers, and billionaires like the Kochs, who create a climate in which they can continue to rape the entire economic situation here in this country and have a bunch of white people and some blacks cheering as they do it. Until you can change that mindset, there's very little you're going to do about changing any of the other things that we're in here talking about. Because what we're talking about is systemic to that. If you removed all of that out of the situation and said, we're going to play on fair ground now. So everybody is going to be treated exactly right. We're going to give you justice. The minute you put justice in the mix, that means that you're supposed to be dealing with everybody who's called a citizen on the same equal plane, whether they have $1 billion, $1 million, or $75. That changes how we're going to start relating to each other, because right now we don't relate to each other as human beings. We relate to each other as categories. Right now we're in a category. There's the category of black people, the category of white people, the category of rich people, the category of poor people, et cetera. Those need to be dealt with fairly. If we can do all of that, we can make a change. But as long as somebody is sitting with a dollar bill over top of this system, and this is the other thing. This has never been about color. It's always been about money. You can go back to the populist movement, and I know you're familiar with that movement. That movement was against white farmers and people who were in that dynamic, and they treated them identically to the way they dealt with black people who were in an uprising against them. The exact thing. All of the same riots, et cetera. All of that happened. The only way those people got out of it is they refused to buckle under to the buck, and they finally made a deal for themselves that could partially work. The minute they took it into the political sphere, they got busted, and it broke down the whole thing, and it was back to business as usual. Brian, so I throw that in the mix. Okay, I know that's a lot to say, but I throw that in the mix.
Brian Stevenson, who recently wrote a book, Just Mercy, says that in his years of advocacy on behalf of people who have been wrongly accused within the criminal justice system and fighting for their innocence to get them released and vindicated, he says that he's learned that the opposite of poverty isn't wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. And I think Baltimore City, along with other jurisdictions across the nation, but I think Baltimore City is sort of, I don't want to use the term poster child, but I think it sort of demonstrates that sentiment, that the opposite of, because you can look at investments that have been made in Baltimore City. You know, this community development plan, that master plan, you know, people talk about the investments that were made in Sandtown Winchester and why is it that Sandtown Winchester looks the way it looks right now. You know, people have talked about, you know, investments that have been made in Park Heights and why does Park, you know, Southern Park Heights still, because wealth or money or just money alone isn't going to solve the problem. The opposite of poverty and the systemic racism, the institutionalized discrimination that we see right now, the opposite of that isn't more money. The opposite of that is justice. And I think what you have right now are people all over Baltimore City of all shapes and sizes and colors, but particularly of a younger generation and mostly African American who are standing up and saying, yes, we do want more investments in our community, but in addition to that, we also want justice. What we have been denied is justice. The reason why we go to an alternative economy is because we can't participate in the mainstream economy. We're locked out of it, literally and figuratively. So we're going to go over here and create our own economy with our own rules and our own culture because there's no equity. There's no equity in that other system for us. So we're going over here.
So I want to go to the phones here and see what people are thinking about, what they think should happen. But I really want to focus on how we have a mayoral election coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say that I'm excited, but we have a mayoral election coming up. And one of the issues has to be is how we begin to change what we do in the city. I was glad to see in this morning's paper that the city, I haven't read the article yet, I need to finish the article, how big it's going to be, but they're going to, instead of attacking safe streets because of one bust, they're going to expand safe streets. But they need to expand a lot of things. And so the question is, how do we get to that point and what should be the changes we make and how we get there? Let's see what our listeners think. At 410-319-8888, Kenneth, line 3, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
Good morning, Kenneth.
Yes. Who is the gentleman that is there with you? I'm sorry. You can get his name.
Avon Bellamy.
This gentleman has said everything correct and everything I've been saying for months on WEAA, on all the shows. And thank you, sir. Okay. Let me say my little bit, though. But if money is not going to solve the problem, politics is not going to solve the problem, churches and everything else, then here's what I have. Remember how the city was when we bought the and I know you're gonna get mad, some people ain't gonna agree.
What is it?
Remember how when we had the National Guard here, or you might want to say the boots on the ground, when we had the National Guards here, remember how calm, remember how good you felt because the crime rate had went down to zero. Remember that? They were only here for 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks? We need to bring them back. Bring them back, and however long it takes, keep them here. Because it made a difference. And while everybody, while the police department trying to figure out their strategy, politics are trying to figure out their strategy, the community trying to figure out their strategy, we're going to keep the National Guard here to give order. That's what it takes. That's all they people understand right now. This is all Baltimore understands.
So we need martial law.
No, I understand the point that the brother is making. But he missed why that happened. He missed why there was a zero. He missed it because what actually happened that created that zero time crime rate was the gangs coming to a truce. The gangs are all over the city. The troops were just at North Avenue. They weren't all over the city, so they couldn't have stopped the crime rate. The crime rate didn't stop because the troops was here. The crime rate stopped because everybody got a common enemy. to be against. Mm. And once you have a common enemy, you put your little petty disputes away. We need to get to the point where we don't need a common enemy to create that same dynamic. When our common enemy becomes to be against the lack of education and quality educational systems, and not only that, because, you know, you can say what you want for education, but until you educate the victim of a racist system to his power and who he is, and you can show him that every single time you lose one black life, you have lost an incredible amount of information and a gift that you had no idea what its potential was. And I'll give you a couple of examples of what I mean. Think of, and I'll go back a ways, George Washington Carver. Think of what would have happened if he'd been cut off in his life. That's a black mind, and look what it created. Right now, people wouldn't be running around here having all of these health things being addressed by soybean, soy milk, et cetera. It's things that he created a whole industry around with. I think it was something like 200 or 300 different kinds of ways for it to be used: lipstick, perfume, goods for the people in World War II when they were fighting. All of that kind of stuff came out of one black mind. We got millions of black minds with thoughts like that in them. And not enough of them being able to be put out there. Now, I've worked in the white system, and what I found out is that, you know, smart black men and are not that welcomed in it, to tell you the truth. So when you are actually putting out thoughts that are real thoughts and talking about situations that are real situations and coming up with ways of dealing with them that doesn't fit what the power structure thinks, and we know that because we did it, every program that we were involved in wasn't supposed to work.
And I think the difference was, so I'm going to segue into it.
No,
it's cool. I mean, because I think to Tara to come in here is one of the things that Avon was alluding to. Then I think the difference is that the programs then were funded by the federal government,
true,
in the city, not by foundations. So that the money then went to black men and women who ran programs in the city. The majority of the workers and supervisors were black.
Right.
The staff was mixed racially,
right,
but they were black-run organizations and racially mixed, and actually had an effect where when we worked at pretrial intervention,
right,
our recidivism rate was like
almost
nothing, maybe 10%.
I don't even think it was 10%.
It may have been, right, you know, and they came to us for 3 to 6 months of intensive work, mm-hmm, individual counseling, group counseling, how to handle yourself at work, getting your GED or getting through high school, and actually these were kids who were arrested first or second time juvenile offenders. And so I'm saying, Tara, it's how do we take what we learned from the past, make it work now, and put it into work, and do things like take advantage of a gang truce, which, mm-hmm, we didn't do, mm-hmm, right, that we could have taken advantage of to bring these kids to the table and begin to change what was going on.
And I think Mr. Bellany's point, you know, about why you saw the crime rate just during that period is because there was a truce, right? It wasn't like the way he explained it was perfect, so I'm not going to repeat it. So I think, you know, so you had those young men in that room face to face with each other saying, we've laid our guns down, but we didn't have the thing to plug them into. We couldn't take that immediately and immediately say, okay, now here. And we have to take some ownership of that. It's not that programs don't exist. It's just that are they what these young people are looking for and what these young people need? Because to be frank, if I am slinging and I'm bringing home, and right, I'm about to show my ignorance, but I'm bringing home $500, $1,000,
$1,500, $3,000 a day. If you're lucky. Most don't get that much. Right.
But let's just say, let's be conservative, though, and let's say $400 or $500 a day, right? Then you tell me you're going to put me in a workforce training program, and during that training period, I'll be good if I bring home that much in a week. It takes a little much for me to sort of make that transition from this lifestyle to that lifestyle. And so to your point, I think OSI Baltimore, the foundation that I work for, we recognize that our job is not to replace government. We can never make the level of investment in anything that government can make. We don't have that kind of money. We simply don't. We can't make the level of investment in any effort or plan that a government can make. What we try to do is make investments to show government, look, this works. You should invest in this. And so they'll replace what it was we're doing.
So we have to have a very quick break here for a news break and come right back to this conversation. I'll also add into this conversation what's happened at the city jail and how that affects all of this and what our alternatives are, given that they closed this down. So please stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're also going to be joined for the second part of this conversation by DeMonte Brown, who's director of Out for Justice and co-chair of the Unlock the Vote Coalition. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Avon Bellamy, senior community leader, activist, poet, writer, and minister.
Yeah, that's correct.
Let me put that out there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, put that out there. I'm the Reverend Avon Bellamy.
I still have a hard time with that. But
I know.
Just
I know.
I'm just teasing.
No, a lot of people have a hard time with it because I'm not religious, and that's the problem. Shut up. I'll tell your secrets, too.
I didn't say anything.
Look, we have known each other and done work together. Mark had some of the most original ideas, and really, I say this to him, you had some of the most original ideas for how to go deal with people in communities when you were doing that street theater stuff. Because that did on-the-spot problem-solving in an entertainment venue where people would call out their issue, and then you would actually work through and show them how to work through those issues. And we need stuff like that now.
We do. I mean, we have
we
to
need
think
stuff
it,
like that
thing,
now.
Not the same way we think about the way we usually do things. I think that's I mean, the work we did together back in PrEP and PTI and other places was really important
that
work,
was good
I think.
Work.
Sheila Dixon actually worked with us back at PrEP.
That's right.
She was a counselor in PrEP when we were there.
She was a counselor.
So
we did good work.
Tara Huffman's here, Director of Criminal and Juvenile Justice Programs for OSI Baltimore. We're also now joined by DeMonte Brown, who is the Director of Out for Justice, an incredibly important group in our city, and co-chair of Unlock the Vote Coalition. DeMonte, welcome. Good to have you back with us. You there? We have her there?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we got you. We got you. All right, good. So before we go to the phones here, I want to read something, and then before we talk a bit about the jail, which is what we're going to go to today, about what this means and how this fits into the scheme of everything. If I can find this thing we just had. Oh, here it is. So we got a comment before we went to break from Clarence. He wrote in, there's a big difference between a functional community where people work and invest in that community with pride in it and extract a sense of pride and well-being. Baltimore's a city used as an economic extraction point where the money flows out in other people's pockets who live somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Can't disagree.
So I mean,
in many communities, that is in fact the case.
Exactly.
And I think it's kind of a multifaceted approach that we got to take in this city from investing in the kind of programs that might actually work that are run by people in the community to, you know, I'm thinking about all these empty places we have and these young gang members, as we used to say to them when we worked with them 40 years ago, was a man without a plan is the victim of the man with a plan. Remember that?
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things is teaching these young people that, you know, some of these young gang members could end up running the corner store themselves.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a coffee shop or a grocery store or whatever that is, and building community. I mean, Little Willie started off as Little Willie Adams, who was a major philanthropic figure and a leader of the black community, started out running numbers, making his money, and then invested in companies. He bought Cars Beach. He opened, right, which is the only place black folks could swim. He helped make – there would have been no Park Sausages without Little Willie's money.
Look, I'm glad you brought him up because that is such a perfect example of what you can do when you have a man who has a vision not only for himself, before his community, because he could have took all that numbers hustling money and did a whole bunch of things. But see, this is what I know about him. He sent people to college.
Yes, he did.
He saw talent. The minute he saw the talent, he put his arm around it and drew it in. He created a political organization for West Baltimore that did
district,
a lot of
the,
good
right?
that did a lot of good work. He put people down there in the city council. and in the state house that did work for those communities. What we got now is a bunch of people who are what I call it low-witted entrepreneurs that's taking the money and going somewhere buying Lexus cars and diamond rings, et cetera, who have no vision. They don't understand that they are part of a community that they need to raise with them. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't gotten that image yet. They just, they freelancers.
There's a solution that has been proposed post Freddie Gray is the One Baltimore initiative that's currently being held up by Mr. Michael Crier, and he and I have sat down and had several conversations. The challenge of One Baltimore is how to be relevant and how not to be just another initiative, but how to be something truly transformative. I think one of the challenges of One Baltimore is how do you create a culture, not just a plan or a program, but how do you create a culture that will identify, recognize, and honor the work of the Willie Adams and the other grassroots folks in the neighborhood and recognize them as real solutions that need to be invested in. In other words, don't just make them the sub-grantee, right? Make them the grantee. Invest directly in them because they know the neighborhood, they know the people, they're invested because this is where they grew up. Like you said, you're talking about my family now. You're not just talking about somebody that I have some sort of affinity for because, you know, we happen to be of the same race or the same religion. No, I know these people and they know me. And so I know what it is we need. And if you give me the resources, I know how to direct them in the right place. So how do we connect folks? How do we connect the organic problem solvers who live within the communities to the mainstream institutions that have a lot of the resources? And how do we connect them in the way so that those resources flow into a community in a way that doesn't co-opt what's already going on in the community, but helps to amplify it and multiply it so that it can stay right there in the community, grow, and continue to have an even greater impact? And again, I think another challenge of One Baltimore, and you know, I'm not the first one to say it, even Patrick McCarthy, president of the Annie Casey Foundation, has said it, you know, to make Baltimore have not the conversation about race, but actually, as I was saying during the break, own what institutional racism looks like in Baltimore, the impact that it's had on Baltimore, why Baltimore is the way it is right now, and how do we go about undoing that?
Well, let me turn to Diamante Brown here and get your thoughts on this before we start talking about the city jail and the closing of the jail there. But because I think that this conversation we're having now is important, and I'd like to help us facilitate that conversation in a broader sense here on this program in the city, because this is just where we have to go mm-hmm. if we're going to make the kind of changes we have to make in this town to save the lives of the future. Old men like us are going to be gone in the next 20 years, but the young men are going to be around here in the next 20 years, meet a world for them to grow into.
Exactly.
So, and Diamante, just before we turn into to talk a bit about the closing of the jail, and Luke Broadwaters has joined us as well, what are your thoughts once you've heard so far?
I think what Tara is saying is absolutely right, and I want to add on to that by saying that the groups like Out for Justice and the grassroots groups, we also have to have enough confidence in ourselves and to demand those leadership positions and to be okay with asking for the money. Because I remember there was a point where I didn't think we were credible enough to ask for a certain amount of money, because that's the way people make you feel. If you're not an attorney, if you're not the mayor, if you're not someone of a certain stature or with a certain title, you start to fulfill that prophecy almost, you know. And so whereas a big agency may ask for the $300,000, you have these smaller agencies knowing or individuals knowing that they need $250,000 to really execute their project, but they're only going to ask for $500 because that's what they think they can get or that's what they think they're worth. And I think that we need to do a better job of empowering each other. And like Tara, and like I think you were saying, Mark, pass that torch on. And like Tara was saying, not make us the sub-grantees. Make us believe in us, trust us that we can do this, that we got this, because we know we're of the community. We know the community. We're from the community. And yes, we do need those people that may not be in a community as the advisors, as the backbone, as maybe to help us form a think tank. But, you know, it's a two-way street is what I'm saying.
Right.
So every have to take a back seat, but we also have to take a step up.
So very quickly, Ivanks, I need to switch topics here. But
every program that I've ever run, the first thing I've done is try to find people in there that's in the client group to put them in a leadership position, because I needed to know how the program was reacting to them. And once I knew, they were giving me feedback saying, well, we don't like this, or this is, I changed the program because the program wasn't for me. It was to show them that. I can remember when the superintendent of schools came down to our program. I don't know if you remember that. Came down to our program, and the entire time he was there, he was dealing with students. And he came to my office very arrogantly and said, all right, now I've been dealing with your staff, and I want to talk to some of these students, because these were supposed to be dropout kids that had been kicked out of school, et cetera. And I told him, I said, the whole while you've been here, you've been talking to kids. And he was like, I said, everybody that you talk to, everybody that carried you around, everybody that explained this program to you was a kid. He didn't believe me. So he went and gathered them all up and put them in one room and talked to them. And he was freaked out when he came back to my office because, see, he had a low expectation for them. And I didn't.
And that's what we do. We have low expectations.
I don't have a low expectations for them. They're intelligent. We get that wrong because we think you put a degree on it, it makes it intelligent. No.
And we need to help them.
I had to hold myself that time.
Yeah, I got you. Luke Broadwater has joined us too, a reporter for The Sun. Good to have you here, Luke. Let me switch gears because we're going to talk about this later. This part of the program, I want to get to this. So Governor Hogan closed the Department's Detention Center. We've seen all this stuff with the Black Royal Family and what was happening with the Detention Center. So there have been a lot of – and there's always been issues there at the Detention Center. So we've closed this Detention Center. But what does that mean? I mean, I read one article in The Sun, I guess it was in The Sun, where many lawyers can't even find the clients, don't know where they went, what prison they're now in, and what's happened to them. So I'll just get your thoughts. And Diamante, let me start with you if I might. Since this is your work day in and day out, so what were your initial thoughts when Governor Hogan closed the detention center, and what are your questions about it? Diamante, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Well, as soon as Mark Gunnery called me and told me that I was going to be on the show, I instantly did my research because I know that a lot of people have statistics and the scholarly response, and I wanted to come with the street response and talk to the people that have actually been in the city jail. So I did. And most of them say it should be closed. And not because of the Black Gorilla Family, but because of the inhumane conditions. Even someone very close to me, my brother, he sat in a city jail for 2 years. And he said, till this day, he still feels like it has some type of effect on his mental health. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are pleading guilty because they can't stand being in a city jail. And when we're talking about inhumane conditions, we're talking about things like the windows are broken in a city jail, right? So when it's really cold outside, and when it's wintertime, you only get this little sheet or this blanket. That leads to certain health conditions that now we're spending more money on. Now people are not in good health, all because of a broken window. And then the showers, so rusty at the bottom that you don't even want to take a shower now because you're taking a shower in rusty water. So what do the inmates do? They use their toilets. They use their toilets to bathe themselves. They use their toilets to store their ice, their lunch meat, their soda. These are the things that are going on behind the walls that people don't want to talk about. And as far as the BGF family is concerned, they brought light to the issue, because these things have been happening. But by them speaking out, and by that brother speaking out, now everyone knows. Everyone it's in the spotlight. And when all of these murders occur behind bars and all of these stabbings occur behind bars, no one asks why. Because people assume that it's a whole bunch of monsters behind bars, and that's just how they are, and that's just what they do. But a lot of those killings are happening because people are trying to survive. Do you know how difficult it is to survive in a city jail? It's almost impossible.
Yep.
Impossible. And then you got these 19-year-olds going in there with low offenses, and they're being exposed to people that are coming through there with double life. I mean, people that have nothing to lose. And internally, there is a system in place where you have inmates coming from maximum security prison, making it possible for them to get into the medium security prisons or low security, because who do you think is easier for them to control? The 60-year-old guy that's been in there for about 30, 40 years, or the 19-year-old that's only been in for 2 months? They want the 19-year-old that's only been in there for 2 months, and guess what? That 19-year-old only has 6 months. They're going to go back out into the street. So not only do they control the jail, now they control the streets too, all through city jail.
So,
and that's why it needs to be shut down.
Diamante, you just laid it out. And Luke, I mean, I'd like you to follow up with that before we turn to Tara here, to follow up with that in terms of the reporting and what you've discovered as well.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think most people praised Governor Hogan's decision to close the Baltimore City Men's Detention Center. But the devil's always in the details, right?
Right.
So yes, this building in some parts was built before the Civil War. It's old, it's decrepit, the conditions are terrible, both for inmates and correctional officers. And, you know, many people saw this as look, this governor is getting things done. He's a take-charge governor. He comes in, sees a problem, and closes it down. But what does that actually mean, right? This is one wing at that facility. The inmates or the detainees who are held there, because these are people who are awaiting trial or are sentenced to less than 18 months. They are being transferred to other facilities there, many of which are slightly better, but still have many of the same issues in terms of flooding, in terms of heating and air conditioning, in terms of access to mental health and health care. And now you have this added layer where many, because this is being done without a level of transparency, the lawyers don't know where the inmates are, or where the detainees are being held, and they're having a hard time getting in contact with their detainees. Some family members are having a hard time visiting the detainees because they don't know where they are at the facility. So it's creating other problems, even though I think most of you will agree that jail was old, decrepit, dangerous, and needed to be closed down.
So, Tara, let me ask you this. Since you're in the middle of the policy world here, and you know, you address these things all the time and addressing this, so what kind of conversations are taking place with the Hogan administration on, so, okay, you finally close the jail because it's a decrepit place, and we've all known it's decrepit, and I will add that I don't think the Baltimore County Jail is all that much better, given what I've heard about the women's detention center there and women having to stand each other's shoulders to put their sanitary napkins up in the ceiling so they don't freeze to death. But people don't ever talk about that either. It's only the city jail they talk about. County jail is not much better. But what are we talking about? What comes next?
Right.
What are you saying to them? What are they saying to you?
So we are dismayed at the lack of conversation that happened before the governor announced this decision, and we remain concerned at the lack of conversation that's happened since the decision was made. We have people from different parts of the advocacy community reaching out to the administration, reaching out to the Department of Public Safety to ask questions. What's the plan? Have you considered this? Have you considered that? Thus far, not a lot of response. I will say that we've gotten some outreach from Chris Schenck, who's director of the Governor's Office on Crime Control and Prevention.
Right.
He is interested in having a conversation about pretrial, because we are talking about pretrial justice, as both Luke and Damonte said. The majority of the people that we're talking about are people who have not been convicted of anything. They've been accused, but they have not been convicted. So they're not serving time. So their access to their attorneys and their access to their families is critical at this point, because it really is going to make a difference between whether or not they are found guilty or not guilty, or even if they plead or are found guilty, exactly what does the plan look like? You know, what is their sentence and their reentry and reintegration look like afterwards? And so we have made outreach. We're continuing to make those outreach to get those meetings to ask those questions. At this point in time, exactly what we feared would happen is happening. As you said, you know, people are being moved. People are not being notified where they're being moved. And so this was unfortunately a missed opportunity. We endorse the closing of the facility. It's a decrepit facility. It's been putting people's lives at risk, inmate and staff.
That's right.
It's been putting people's lives at risk for decades, for far too long. So we endorsed that the facility needed to be closed. But we think we missed a grand opportunity to do things differently here. We're absolutely, just based on the data and the research that we have, there are a number of people who are within that population who have been moved or transferred someplace else who actually could have been released. They could have been released on community supervision, you know, under pretrial services or some other organization that provides those kind of services. They don't even have to be in a locked facility right now. They could have been safely released into the community, which would have not only increased their own physical and mental safety, but would not have had a negative impact on public safety, because, again, our research has found is that pretrial services, as under-resourced and as underfunded as it is, people who are placed under their supervision, there's a 92% success rate. They do their job, and they do their job
well. Who is the
they? The pretrial services. The pretrial services division within the Department of Public Safety, with the limited resources that they have, they do a good job of making sure their job is to make sure that that person doesn't commit a new offense and shows up for his or her court date. And the data that we show shows that they have a better than 90% success rate. So the question is, why aren't we utilizing them more than we utilize them right now?
And the other issue here is that when you have people under key, you don't have to treat them like you would treat someone else. So a decision like this can be made with no planning, no forethought, or anything else, because as far as people who are looking at the criminal justice system, especially as it comes to incarceration, they're not worth our time to deal with.
And also we have to take into consideration that we are a society that puts profit over people. And
absolutely.
This is an opportunity to create more profit. Now we need a van service to get families to wherever the people are going to be shipped to once they leave there. And now more all of these things are going to come into play. And who's going to get the van contract? Who's going to get the phone contract? Because now there's more people that need to use the phone. Who is going to benefit from all of these things? And I'm going to put it on the table, because a lot of times we don't like to say it, but it's going to be non-black people that benefit from the profit, although black people make up the majority of the prison population in Baltimore City and Maryland.
In the nation.
Let me try to get one before we end the conversation today, but we will come back to this. I think we really need to focus on this and see if we can get the governor's staff to come on and talk about this as well, so we can push this dialogue about where we're going, because I think it's incredibly important about where our system is headed and the opportunities we are squandering, and we can just do something else besides squander but make an opportunity out of this. Let's get a quick call and a final thought before we have to meet the incredible Stanley Cowell, who is waiting to come in the studio and entertain and talk with us as well, one of our great jazz musicians of all time. 410-319-8888. Leo Burrows, go ahead. Very quick thought, though, bro.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Do you think, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Do you think your guests understand the historic and systemic nature of what we did, and you were a part of that in 1963 when we integrated or forced the integration of Jessup's? And
yes.
All these other institutions. These inhuman conditions have always existed in our prison system, systemically, institutional racism. But what's going to happen to these inmates now, many of whom are nonviolent offenders? They're being scattered to where? The Eastern Shore, Hagerstown, Roxborough, no rehabilitation. What's going on with rehabilitation with regard to the governor and the Republicans and the Democrats.
Please.
I would like to know something about that. We talk about the Black Guerrilla Gang, but they don't talk about Gary Maynard, the Secretary of Corrections, and the White Guerrilla Gang that knew what was going on in the detention center. They always knew what was going on. Kayvon White wasn't running the detention center.
No.
White folks ran the detention center.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary Maynard, of course, is a crony of Martin O'Malley.
Well, I know he's one of your favorite people, Leo.
He's a great. Yeah, and he's still in our system, misusing us. I want to hear somebody comment on those things.
Let me get some quick final thoughts here,
sure.
Because before we have to switch gears. So, Tara, you were going to say what?
No, like I said, I think we're missing an opportunity here. I think closing the facility is the right decision, but there had to be a plan, and I think that plan, and to Mr. Bellany's point, and that's the part that sort of troubles us, which is why we continue to make outreach to try to get those conversations and figure out what's going on. The individuals who are in the Baltimore City Detention Center, and it's a jail system because it's four facilities, not just the one facility, they're not commodities. And they're not property that you just shift from one place to another because it makes operational sense. You actually had to say, how are we going to ensure access to justice is not interrupted? How are we going to ensure that the family's access to their family members is not interrupted? And how are we going to ensure that we're not moving them from the fire pan and into the fire? Because, again, now I know enough about prison culture and corrections to know that you just took a population of people and moved them into another population of people.
Yeah.
You just disrupted the culture.
The balance of everything.
Right. And so that's going to have some consequences, too. And so what's the plan to deal with that? And so I don't know enough information to say that the department doesn't have a plan. I'm saying that the plan needs to be more public and it needs to be shared with more stakeholders so that everybody can come together and make this work because it's an opportunity to do things differently in Baltimore City.
So, look, to wrap up for us in terms of what you plan to look at next. I mean, the red line shut down. We've seen no plan about that. Now we shut the city jail. We've seen no plan what comes after that. So what are you looking at next?
Sure. Just a couple points on the jail. One, our reporting has showed so far that no one's been sent to the Eastern Shore or Western Maryland. They've just been moved to other facilities inside the complex in East Baltimore. I know that was a concern of many people, but we haven't seen that happen yet. Two, one of the only reasons this closing of the jails is impossible is because the arrest rate has fallen so dramatically from the Martin O'Malley days, where you have now empty space at the jail that people can be moved to. But three, we still remain as a country by far the highest in terms of prison population, even more than China and Russia. So it's still a major concern for the country, not just Baltimore City.
And Baltimore City remains among the top cities that incarcerates more, even with the drop, incarcerates more of its citizens pretrial than other major cities
in
the nation.
And we've seen what happens when we looked at the New York Times article on Judge Gordon and what she did in her mm-hmm. court, putting people in jail for the most ridiculous reasons in the city. And they can't, and we're not holding the judges accountable for what they're doing either. So, but we're going to come back to this in the next 2 weeks. I really want to see where we're going and get this panel in for a much longer session on the jail and a longer panel on what we're going to do about our violence and changing our programs in the city. I think they both deserve more time on the air. We're going to do that and bring back Diamante Brown because you do great work for Out for Justice. Diamante, I think you're one of our critical leaders, and I appreciate you taking the time for our program today and look forward to you coming in studio for a longer time.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
I'll see you soon.
See you soon. And Luke Broadwater, thanks for the work you're doing at The Sun. Appreciate all this stuff, and we're looking forward to having you on more. Tara Hoffman, I was pleased to be in touch and talk to you more about what we can all do with OSI to get this thing
Absolutely.
On the ground here in this city. And my dear friend, Avon Bellamy, thank you, brother, for being here. And
my pleasure.
Always good to see you.
Yeah,
always.
Same here.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care, Luke. So we're going to take a brief break. On the way to break, you're hearing a piece called We Shall Too by the great Stanley Cowell, who will join us with his daughter, Sunny. We're looking forward to this conversation with them. They'll be in town, and doesn't come through often. It's good to have him here. Stay with us. We'll be right back.